And at this stage, I think we know that certain kind of reform is not possible anymore, that major changes need to happen in Iran. The capacity for reform has reached a point that people know the constitution needs to change.
Today on Rethinking Religion, we're discussing new media in Iran and what changes websites like Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter have brought to journalism. In this program, two interviews. The first with Nazila Fati, the New York Times reporter covering Iran since 2000. The second interview with Kelly Golnoush Niknejad, founder of Tehran Bureau, the online news magazine, which first gained recognition for its on-the-ground coverage of the Iranian elections.
I think whatever it was is just a lot worse, and they've actually reduced the playing field so that there's fewer political rivals who get to have a paper. I mean, they've shut down so many newspapers, and they've thrown so many journalists into prison, and there's been such an exodus, you know, of people, especially journalists coming from Iran. So no, it's gotten a lot worse.
Also in this program, Rethinking Religion goes to a conference at Columbia University with Iranian journalists, including blogger Omid Mamarian and Mehdi Yayanajad, co-founder of Balataran, to talk about the challenges they face in Iran and what that means for the country. Stay with us for Rethinking Religion from Columbia University's Institute for Religion, Culture, and Public Life.
Rethinking religion.
I'm Norris J. Chumley. One of the more prominent journalists covering Iran for a decade is Nazila Fati. She's a reporter for the New York Times and was based in Tehran from 2001 until July 2009, when she was forced to leave under pressure from the government. Nazila Fati's been covering Iran from Toronto ever since. I had the chance to speak with her the other day by phone.
Could you give us a bit of a background to the political and economic climate in Iran leading up to the elections?
The political situation started to change after the election of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in 2005. He practically started enforcing a lot of restrictions from the early days of the revolution, especially on younger people, at students, at student activists. I can say with confidence that there was not much left, for instance, from the student movement that was very active in the early 2000s, after 2005 when he was elected. He also started enforcing restrictions against younger people, younger women over their dress code, and younger men over how they wore their hair or their clothing, which was one of the major reasons why so many younger people were very frustrated and angry after the election. The economy has been not in a very good shape since the election of Mr. Ahmadinejad, mostly because of his own mismanagement and bad decision making.
You mentioned young people and students. This program is not only about Iran and journalism, it's also about new media, such as blogs, Twitter, Facebook, social media on the internet. Was there much media, social media, in Iran prior to the elections?
Yes. According to the most recent figures, about 18 million people are connected to the internet, and just compare this figure to early 2000 when there were only 1 million people on the internet. Of course, all this 18 million people are not savvy users, but they get a lot of their information from the internet, and these people have families, they have relatives. Whatever they learn from the internet, the information, the political, about the cultural issues, whatever they learn, they tell their families about them. And it has a sort of opened a window for a lot of people into the lives of people in the West. A lot of people are comparing what they have in Iran or even in the Middle East, what is available to other people their age at Western countries. And they want those freedoms. They want those rights.
How prevalent is traditional media in Iran?
Well, a lot of people still get their information from the state-run television, but altogether we can say that people have lost their confidence in the state-run news, and that's why so many people have turned to news sources that are beamed on satellite. A lot of the opposition television channels are on opposition on satellite now, and also independent sources of news like the Persian language VOA or the BBC. And that has been one of the concerns of the government as well, that more and more people are turning to news channels that are on satellite, and they are illegal if the government seizes those equipment. It fines people, but people don't care and still use satellite.
Is there much censorship? I know it's quite difficult to censor satellite-delivered television channels and other media, but we know in many countries, such as China, that there is censorship and also jamming of radio stations and shortwave. Does that occur in Iran as well?
Yes, on a very large scale. Iranians have become good experts on how to jam these programs. They use two various methods. One of them was sending signals to the satellite itself to jam the programs. The other way that Iran tries to jam these channels is through mobile equipment that it has. And this is very dangerous for people's health because they go from one neighborhood to another neighborhood with mobile equipment and jam the waves.
What about the Internet? What about censorship of the Internet? A lot of the news of the elections that took place now a few years ago, the outside world away from Iran, this is how we got the news, by people tweeting and on Facebook. What about inside Iran?
Yes, it was the same thing. Internet became a very important tool to spread information, to create networks, to organize people, to mobilize people. People started writing on the Internet whatever they couldn't publish in newspapers because the government was shutting down newspapers. But the government even tried to crack down on that. First of all, every time it's close to an event that people might want to stage protests or demonstrations, the government slows the Internet to practically a crawl, and it's impossible to use it. Hundreds of weblogs and news websites have been blocked. But people have come up, both inside the country and outside the country, have come up with a lot of software that helps them circumvent such restrictions.
What was it like to report in Iran in the last decade, particularly as a woman, for such established high-level publications like the New York Times and the New York Review of Books?
I think being a woman helped me in many ways because Iranian society has been segregated in many ways since the 1979 revolution. And as a woman, I could go to many public spaces where both men and women could go, and to a lot of spaces which only belonged to women, and men were not allowed to go. So in that term, it gave me more access than another colleague who would have been probably a man. But other than that, I must say that Iranian society has gone through profound change, especially its women in the past decade. The people, especially women, have become much more educated in the past three decades. And women... A lot of these children who have gone to universities have come of an age in the past 10 years. The gap between traditional women and more religious women has narrowed.
You mentioned that an official at the Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance in Iran actually refused to give you a press pass and credentials and instructed the New York Times to present an older male candidate instead. What happened ultimately with that?
Well, I had to wait until that official was removed and a new person was appointed. That was in the late 90s, and that official who refused to give me a press card was actually a reformist. But I believe that these are the cultural issues that don't go away easily and requires time for people to start believing in women and their capabilities. Unfortunately, I had to wait until 2000 for the new official to come and give me and several other women press credentials so that we could work.
You're listening to Rethinking Religion. As with all of our programs, we strive to offer a multi-perspective view on people and their ideas and the values, traditions, and beliefs that influence them. To join in the conversation, check out our blog at ircpl.org. We now return to our conversation on Iran and new media with New York Times reporter Nazila Fatti.
You wrote that many believed in Iran that what happened in 2009 was more than a rigged election, that it was actually a coup d'etat by the Revolutionary Guards. Can you talk a little bit about the Revolutionary Guards and the Bazij, the paramilitary volunteer militia?
Yes, the Revolutionary Guards and its paramilitary arm, which is the Bazij, started increasing their influence and their power from the early 2000s, practically to be very precise since the parliamentary elections. Suddenly many of the reformist politicians were barred from running, and the new members who replaced them were former members of the Revolutionary Guards. They started climbing the ladders of politics by being allowed to run in the elections while all other veteran politicians were being barred from running. Even though the turnouts were quite low, but they managed to get in. And then with the election of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in 2005, he appointed many of these members of the Revolutionary Guards as his ministers, cabinet members, and practically parliament and the government were dominated by powerful members of the Revolutionary Guards, not people who had only served in the war, because a lot of other politicians had also served in the war, but these people had remained within the guards. They were royal members, and they were very, very conservative figures. And we even witnessed that a lot of clergy were being dismissed from the positions that they had held, and in many ways they were much more moderate and pro-reform than the new members of the Revolutionary Guards who were replacing them.
You wrote in Foreign Policy magazine 10 days after the presidential election that you received a call from a sympathetic member of the Bazij, the pro-government military force, a call that warned you that you'd be shot by snipers if you continued going out. Agents were camped outside your door, chaos descending all around you after the election. Visiting journalists were expelled. Resident journalists were barred from stepping outside their offices. How did you go about reporting the elections?
Yes, suddenly the circumstances became dramatically different than before. That's why it was even tangible to feel that there was something like a coup d'etat going on. I continued to go out even after that member of the Bazij, who just was trying to be friendly, told me that they had identified me and there were snipers who were shooting people, and I would be shot as well if I continued going out. I did go out, but of course the fear was there. I had seen people who were shot. There were videos of people who had been shot, and we had seen them dying. So the fear was always there. But after I realized that my house was under surveillance, and I went out, and four cars started tailing me, I just went back, and I was practically under a kind of house arrest until the evening that I left the country.
Well, what were the circumstances of your departure shortly after the 2009 elections?
Well, we noticed that the surveillance team was leaving every night at midnight. And I already had my ticket from months before, which was supposed to be a planned vacation. And our flight was not until 5 o'clock in the morning. So when they left at midnight, we got in the car and we went to the airport, and nothing happened at the airport, fortunately.
In Foreign Policy magazine, you say that despite the obstacles of reporting from outside Iran, the media has generally done a remarkable job in properly identifying the enormity of the Green Movement.
I would still say the same thing. I disagree with those who claim that the protests were not as enormous or significant as many others have said it was. It's not a simple thing for 3 million people to defy a government ban, come out on the streets and march in silence and show such signs of civility. I mean, all that shows that this country, its people are ready for major changes and for democratic ones.
Mm-hmm. In your foreign policy article, you said that there were telltale signs that were observable from abroad, such as public positions Iranian leaders, such as Ayatollah Rafsanjani, took in response to the protests. Could you give me a little more detail on that, a little more background?
Well, Mr. Rafsanjani, for example, along with Mr. Khamenei, are the only leaders from the early days of the revolution who were alongside with Mr. Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini, the founder of the revolution, and are still around. I mean, you would consider both of them as the owners of the revolution. And when the two men become so different in their positions, and actually one of them takes position against the other one, or at least against his policies, that shows a huge rift within the establishment. And there are no secrets that major parts of the establishment, Mr. Ahmadinejad, they would like to go after Mr. Rafsanjani in very harsh ways. Mr. Rafsanjani has lost a lot of his clout. He has been stripped off his power. He doesn't lead the Friday prayers anymore. The government has gone after his children. His son is outside the country. There's an arrest warrant for him. His daughter-in-laws were arrested. His son, grandson was arrested. These are not small issues for somebody who has been one of the founders of the revolution.
Mm. We hear a lot of reports, blogs, and things coming out of Iran. What about the state of journalism in Iran? What about the safety of journalists who are still there?
That's one of the worst situations. Increasing numbers of journalists have left the country. I mean, we still hear about many of them who are leaving illegally, going to northern Iraq. A lot of them are in Iraq, in Turkey, waiting to get refugee status to other countries. A lot of journalists who became so good in the past 10 years, and this is a loss of human resources for a country. It's going to take years for Iran to train so many good journalists. A lot of them have gone outside the country and are working for foreign language television networks outside the country.
Mm-hmm.
This is certainly a loss for Iran. It's good that these people have jobs outside the country and are working, because in some ways they can help the process of democratization in the country. They can still provide information for people inside the country, but it's not good that they're not in the country working on newspapers and publications that are being published inside the country.
You're still reporting on Iran. How are you able to maintain direct sources, and how do you know what's going on if you're not there?
It is harder. It is much harder to report from a distance when you're not able to go out on the streets to talk to people directly to see how things have changed. But I had worked there for 10 years. I got to know a lot of people, both professionals and people who still live there, who can tell me how life is. And my sources, a lot of my sources were arrested, and clearly I couldn't call them. Even the ones who have been released, I don't call them because I'm afraid that I might put them in some kind of jeopardy. They might be taken back to prison. But there are other sources who are talking sometimes on the record, sometimes off the record. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who are willing to reach out and talk about what's going on.
Do you rely at all on social media, new media, internet, blogging?
Of course I do rely on them, but I try to check everything, double check everything with sources inside the country.
Mm-hmm. We note that your Twitter feed has only had one tweet.
Yes, unfortunately, I haven't been very active on Twitter. There are so many other sources, and they take up a lot of time.
Kind of hard to put everything in a 140-character version of a report, I can imagine, certainly.
Yes.
So what do you think the future is for Iran, your country? What's next? What's happening? Where is it going?
Well, I don't expect an overnight change in Iran. I don't think there is going to be a revolution, or even I never thought that there would be a revolution last year. Definitely the core of the regime has been shaken. Definitely a new era has started in Iran, in the same way that a new era started in 97 after the election of Mr. Khatami, a new reform era. And at this stage, I think we know that certain kind of reform is not possible anymore, that major changes needs to happen in Iran. The capacity for reform has reached a point that people know that, for example, the constitution needs to change. And sooner or later, the government would realize that as well. I mean, so far, the government has not tried to find a solution to the crisis. They have tried just to end it. And the anger and the frustration is still there. It's still simmering beneath the surface. And last year, it appeared in that explosive response. This is not the first time that the government has ended protests. It tried to end protests in 98 after the student uprising and several other times in early 2000. And every time they ended it, it just appeared in a much more explosive way. To think that this has ended, that the movement is end, I believe is a big mistake.
Our thanks to Nazila Fati, New York Times reporter and contributor to the New York Review of Books. For complete and unedited interviews, please visit our Rethinking Religion website at ircpl.org. There you'll also find interviews, blogs, transcripts, and other programs on the intersection of religion, culture, and public life. Our program continues. Recently, Rethinking Religion attended a conference at Columbia University on the state of journalism in Iran and the role that social media websites played in the 2009 election protests. Here is Devar Ardalan of NPR introducing the next speaker.
And that takes us to Omid Memarian, who is a well-known Iranian-American news analyst who writes regularly blogs in English and in Farsi. He contributes to the Huffington Post and the Inner Press services. So I'd like to welcome Omid Memarian.
To start with, I would like to say a few words about the characteristics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I think that the Islamic Republic of Iran, if you want to make it shorter, we can call it the Republic of Propaganda. The Islamic Republic of Iran, after the revolution, they established a lot of institutions to dominate their ideology and their message and control the crowd. They established, for example, a lot of organizations that are, you know, in charge of this work. We have, for example, the Council of Friday Prayers. For example, you have somebody in Tehran send a message to all Friday prayers in the other cities and even small villages. In like 1 hour, 2 hours, they know what they have to say Friday, you know, when they preach people. We can add to this the Islamic propaganda organization, which operates in major, in all the cities, and they have offices in small villages. They have a huge propaganda machine. And they have been so consistent to spread their ideology all over the country and fight with those who challenge their narrative. The post-election unrest in Iran was a wake-up call for the Islamic Republic. Up to that point, I think they were fairly successful to control the crowd, to dominate their message in the throughout the country. But imagine, after the election, for example, a 20-year-old guy shoot a video and in like 2 hours posted on YouTube, and millions of people see what's going on the streets of Tehran and the other cities, and those videos, those images really challenged the Islamic Republic's of Iran's narrative over the events after the election. And it was so brutal because it was not done by Fox News or CNN or the other news agencies that the Islamic Republic always criticized them. It was by citizens who just wanted to share what's going on in the city. That really damaged the image of the Islamic government in Tehran, and that was a wake-up call for them. And that's why we are seeing that after the election, after a few months, they were so confused. But now they are aggressively working on the internet, and they're trying to block the flow of information. And they are working on a very advanced censorship systems. They have a very good relationship with Chinese, who are the masters in this field. And I think in a few years, they think that they can, you know, continue the way they were operating before the internet era. And it's really significant. It's very important to understand the propaganda machine of the Islamic Republic and how it's really powerful, strong, well-funded, gigantic, and all over the country. I believe providing access for Iranians to information is the most vital thing that we can do here out of the country. And this is something that some people, many Iranians actually after the election, they have been focusing on this. And I think we should pursue this path to provide more information for Iranians. They let them give them power, give them voice to be able to challenge the government's narrative. Just to give you an example of how providing information is important, or providing access to information, I think the Khatami's era is a very good example. What happened in that period, President Khatami opened up the society, and journalists flourished, and we were able to write about things that we could not write before that period. Even though it was not that much, but still it was really challenging for the Islamic Republic of Iran, for those conservative institutions that could not even tolerate us. So, and the society really changed over that period. People who lived in that period in Iran, they know that the society during Khatami's period was definitely a different society. I believe that there are many ways to struggle, to fight with the Islamic Republic's misinformation industry. We have to provide information, you know, write in information for those who are living in Iran, because the Islamic Republic really has a misinformation factory, that they provide information that doesn't make sense, it's wrong, and they make perceptions for the Iranian people that I think we should work on that area.
We're listening to conversations from a recent conference at Columbia University in New York City on journalism and social media in Iran. Next to speak is Mehdi Yayanajad, founder of Balataran, one of the most influential Persian language social media websites.
Blogging was an important issue. In fact, to the before the election, it was a place that many bloggers discussed whether Mousavi is the best person or Karoubi is the right person, or they should now vote or should vote, or and there were even Ahmadinejad supporters who were blogging to support Ahmadinejad. What changed? I think one thing that happened before the election was quite significant. Iranian government, for whatever reason, removed the filtering for Facebook or YouTube. We don't know why they did it, their mistake. What happened was lots of people got on Facebook, signed up on Facebook, and started also using YouTube. Facebook grew phenomenally in that period of a short period of time. It was a period of 2 months, I would say maybe 2 months to 3 months. And everybody was just asking, why are Iranian governments doing this? I mean, it was just, there are conspiracy theories. Maybe they are trying to figure out mapping every single IP to an identity, because the Facebook doesn't run over HTTPS and the Iranian government could easily look at the traffic. So Facebook, YouTube just became, in fact, more important right before the election. Facebook was used heavily by Mousavi's campaign to promote Mousavi. Both Mousavi and Rahnavard, Mousavi's wife, who was also very involved in the campaign, Mousavi's campaign, had a user account on Facebook, and that was kind of a source of place to go to when you were looking to see what is the official stance of Mousavi on a certain thing, whether people should go to a demonstration or should not. So people who were following Mousavi, they usually, that was a reference point, because in many cases Mousavi's website was not responsive or down, or so Facebook was much more reliable in that sense. So Facebook became really important, helped the campaign, and also it created a kind of sense of solidarity among Iranians that something's happening. I mean, before the election, there was a discussion of whether there should be, people should vote, should not vote. But once everybody saw that amount of activity on Facebook, and also, I mean, the streets of Tehran, they realized that something is happening. I mean, in fact, I saw it among many people who did not want to vote. They changed their mind. They said, okay, it seems this time is different. There are lots of people on the street and the mood is different. So that was, I would say, that was Facebook's involvement. Facebook was a good platform to communicate from Iran to outside Iran and outside Iran to Iran. So that was I would say it was a two-way connection. It was one among the platforms. It was a two-way connection platform. YouTube was really essential in what happened after the election. I mean, it changed the dynamic entirely in terms of the old media and new media. It forced old media to follow the suit. It just, in for many years, you had these stupid ideas about articles in major newspaper about nose jobs, surgeries, and so on in Iran. And like, it was, I mean, Khatami's reform pretty much ended in around 2000, 2001, but you could still see articles about how Khatami's reforms are great when at the time that Khatami's reform was dead. It was basically the old media moved so slowly, I mean, and they repeat things that already been printed many years ago and have lost their freshness. So that, for basically, it was, we didn't see that much change until social media was heavily, came up with so many new things. And because of the videos, it was easy to prove that something's happening. We thought video, I mean, we were reading those things in blogs, but it was hard to prove those things. But once people see that, oh wow, there are thousands of people on the street, there's maybe police attacking demonstrators or some violent scenes, that changes the impression. And also it provided material for TV channels. TV channels wanna have something to show. They're not gonna read blog posts to their audience. It's just gonna be a boring thing. So YouTube videos provided that material.
Rethinking Religion had the opportunity to ask Mehdi Yayanejad about how his social networking website can foster a dialogue between the religious and non-religious in Iran.
From my observation on Bahrain, we had a fair number of religious users, especially 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and we have fewer of them, unfortunately. Part of that was because of the fact that most of the people who are secular are to some degree anti-religious, at least the vocal ones in the Iranian community. When people who are anti-religious and disrespectful to Islam, they usually ask things that might be about historical facts or, I don't know, like about the wives of Prophet Muhammad or, I mean, just things that are disrespectful for a Muslim. I mean, they truly get offended by it. And just if you ask this question from practicing Muslim, they will get offended and they won't continue any discussion no matter what. And this sort of things, any platform, this is something, I mean, I really don't know the answer to it. Any platform you create that has freedom of expression and you don't edit any of the content, you don't moderate, it's going to give space for all sorts of views, of course, but considering the fact that more religious, more conservative people get offended by certain things, they'll be less likely to engage in any conversation of that sort. And that I've seen that in Bahrain, and I'm looking for ideas to see how this kind of engagement could be done in a constructive way without a need for too much moderation or too much basically enforcing rules from the top. So,
Iranian-American journalist Kelly Golnoush Niknejad was present at that conference at Columbia. She talked about the website she founded, Tehran Bureau, which was the main source of news for English-speaking audiences following the 2009 elections, especially after the Iranian government banned mainstream media from covering the demonstrations. Tehran Bureau then served as a hub for all the news that poured in via Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, and continues to publish features and news articles on politics and culture in Iran and the Iranian diaspora. A few days after the conference, I had the chance to speak to Kelly Niknejad by telephone from her office in Boston.
First, I would be very interested in hearing who's the audience for Tehran Bureau.
I think, based on the numbers, most of the hits are coming from the United States. And I think there's probably an audience in Europe, and I think there's an audience in Iran as well, because since we became we started being hosted on the PBS server, the top 10 countries that are accessing PBS, Iran is, the Islamic Republic of Iran is in the top 10. So I think they're probably coming to PBS to, you know, read Tehran Bureau or follow events on Tehran Bureau. So it's very difficult to say, but it's an international audience, and I think that's still kind of being worked out.
Is it accurate to say that Tehran Bureau began when the Green Movement began, that is, after the 2009 elections and protests over the election?
Oh, no, not at all. I think it actually started, the seeds were planted when I was at Columbia University as a journalism student. I was doing research on Iran. Every time I did any research on Iran, I feel like the narrative that was coming, that was emerging, was different from what was being reported by the mainstream media. And if you look at the mainstream media, I mean, they have correspondents who have to cover a lot of other things than just Iran. And every so often, when they did report on Iran, it would kind of be a very simple story. And it was going to be one story that covered something that might be interesting to an international audience, and then they weren't going to hear about it again until later on. And it just seemed like there was a better way to cover Iran. And for those journalists who were going to Iran, there was a lot of problems because, you know, you want to be invited back. Your access is important. That's what gives you the job that you have. It just seemed like new media was a great way to put people closer together and help us access people that we wouldn't otherwise have access to. But as the election was coming and nobody was willing to help with the funding, I just decided to move into my parents' house and kind of launch it there as a blog, because that was the cheapest way to do it. It was free and we could publish stories on it.
You said in Harvard's Nieman Reports that, may I quote, "The media in Iran is often state-owned and always closely supervised. Those newspapers not run directly by the state are associated with political parties and prominent figures whose factional rivalries sometimes spill over into the papers. Those in power often assert it by shutting down a rival's mouthpiece." Do you think that that's changed since the elections and changed with the West's concern about nuclear proliferation?
In terms of no longer being state-controlled and no longer being run by prominent political figures?
Shall we say biased and heavily censored?
No, it's still, I think whatever it was is just a lot worse, and they've actually reduced the playing field so that there's fewer political rivals who get to have a paper. I mean, they've shut down so many newspapers, and they've thrown so many journalists into prison, and there's been such an exodus, you know, of people, especially journalists coming from Iran. So no, it's gotten a lot worse.
Does Tehran Bureau reach out to religious right-wing contributors at all?
I reach out to them every so often, those that have credibility. And by credibility is like those who really believe in what they're saying. And it's not so much that, hey, look at this. I mean, there's a lot of people out there, a few people, I should say, out there, that I think if they start writing for us, they might be considered as collaborating with the enemy. I mean, who knows? Because the accusations that get thrown around in Iran are very serious. And so everyone has to watch their back. If the election had not unfolded the way that it had, I think we would have probably had a lot more. In fact, we do have a lot of, we do have people who have very, very religious backgrounds, and we have people who did not, who voted for Ahmadinejad, who are writing for us. So, but I think the election really changed the dynamic of how Iranians themselves, even those who are very religious, even those who are hardliners, think about what's going on. And that's something that the people that are here that are critiquing it fail to see, that even within the very, very conservative hardline camp, there are many divisions. There's a lot of disagreements with Ahmadinejad. But every so often, we do, other sources within Tehran Bureau reach out to them, and, one day maybe they'll come around, maybe when things are more stable. But it has to be someone that I know is not, because I know some of these people, you go back to their writings or what they were saying just, 10 months ago, and you can see that they're just kind of changing their point of views depending on where the wind is blowing,
yes.
So I'm not going to succumb to that. I'm not going to do that just to say, look, I'm giving, coverage to the other side. But it's something that I am and others are constantly working on. We're just trying to find different, maybe more credible ways of doing it. And one of them is just having the press roundup section and translating what is in the Iranian media, what is being said by the hardliners. And once I have money for translators, then we can focus, do more and more of that, and translate newspapers outside of Tehran, translate more of the conservative newspapers that might not have a website.
What's your response to criticism that Tehran Bureau relies too heavily on citizen journalism, that it does not do enough to corroborate some of its reports?
Things are being said by people who don't understand how it works. I think because we have been influential in reporting on Iran, there are people who are trying to undermine that. And I think we've been very open, and more than any other source, about who it is that's doing the reporting, so that you can see the bias that's there. I mean, there's no one who is reporting on Iran that doesn't have a bias, whether they cover it up or not. And I think
Yes.
in this case in particular, not covering it up as being more honest about what's going on. I don't talk about who reports for us, but they're not citizen journalists. And when I'm interviewed about it, I just say I don't want to talk about it, because if you give a profile of who's writing for you, then it makes it easier for the government to crack down on them. So sometimes, most times, we don't even say whether the story was translated or not translated. I have very, very, very difficult standards. But a lot of my colleagues publish in other newspapers I wouldn't publish, because I don't trust the people they're quoting. I don't trust the stories, and the information's all coming from the same place. They're all just translating, opposition websites and whatever the official media is putting out, which is, the basis of their reporting. So,
yes. In one interview that I read, you said something to the effect of things happen so quickly, and I'm paraphrasing you here, things happen so quickly, sometimes you only have time to just cut and paste from various things that you've seen in other places. Does Tehran Bureau have a vetting process, not just for contributors, but also from Twitter posts and comments and blogs?
I know the article that you're referring to. I wasn't saying that I was cutting and pasting. I was saying that I didn't have time to get the information that I was getting firsthand that I trusted, and I couldn't sculpt it into a story. So basically, I just took it and put it on a page, and that page became the basis of like all the reports that were coming through. I didn't say I was going and cutting and pasting from other places.
What's the process? How do you decide who reports for Tehran Bureau? Do you have a set of published editing guidelines? Or?
No, I think because of the circumstances that we're operating under, it's something that I don't talk about at all, because again, it's people that I have to trust completely, and when I have reason not to trust them anymore, I just don't use them. So my standards of vetting any information is much more, I think, higher than most places, because I know that people are much more likely to be critical of what I do. It's something new. It's, Iranian-dominated, Iranian-American-dominated.
Does Frontline or PBS or any funding sources exert any editorial influence, or do you have carte blanche and total control?
I have Tehran Bureau is independent from Frontline, so I have the final say on anything relating to what gets published on Tehran Bureau. But in terms of video or documentaries, I think that's a different story.
Yes. On the Frontline About page, Tehran Bureau is called a virtual bureau connecting journalists, Iran experts, and readers. Executive producer of Frontline, David Fanning, calls this convergence journalism. Do you think this is the new type of journalism?
You know, I don't know what the new wave of journalism is. I know that the internet has allowed others to get into the game. You know, it's loosened the stranglehold that the mainstream media has had on whatever the news is, and it's allowed people to set the agenda even when it's wrong, as in the case of the fact that some of the things that has been said about Tehran Bureau that is completely untrue and is
maybe it's a sign of success when there's controversy and disagreement. Maybe that means that people are really interested and engaged.
That's the positive way to look at it. But how we're going to be able to fund journalism? I think that's how it's going to pay for itself. Who's going to pay for it? I think those are the issues that don't seem very clear in terms of what's going on. But no, I mean, it's actually a very exciting time. I don't have to be a print journalist anymore, and I don't have to be at the mercy of someone else to who's going to say that whether this is newsworthy or not, whether anyone can get into the game. Anyone can get into the game, and I think if you're really devoted to something, whatever it is, you have a better chance of making a mark in journalism than you did in the past. And at the same time, I think it makes journalism education much more important than it was in the past, because if you had the opportunity to train at a big newspaper, you might not have that anymore. And because of the internet, there are fewer filters between what you publish, what you write, and what you publish. You know, you don't have someone who's going to, it's not going to go through 10 editors before, you know, it gets washed out and, you know, run through the attorneys and then published. And so you have to have that. You have to have that yourself. I think education is important because you learn what filters that you have to apply yourself before you publish something.
Kelly Golnush Niknajad, independent journalist, founder, editor of Tehran Bureau. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Rethinking religion.
Our series, Rethinking Religion, explores the intersection of religion and culture in countries around the world. For our program today on Iran, we spoke with Nazila Fatih, New York Times journalist covering Iran, and with Kelly Golnush Niknajad, editor of Tehran Bureau. We also heard from blogger Omid Mamarian and Mehdi Yayanajad, co-founder of Balataran. Rethinking Religion is a project of Columbia University's Institute for Religion, Culture, and Public Life in New York City. To hear the entire unedited conversations, as well as a short summary edition, and for transcripts, visit our website at ircpl.org. I'm Norris J. Chumley for Rethinking Religion.